Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast going on for seven years is starting today when you hear this, because this will air on the 7th. For those who have our gear or shirts or stickers, whatever, and you wondered what the WTSP010718 serial number on that logo means, that's the air date of our very first episode, January 7th of 2018. And we are still here. Sadly, Jeff cannot be with us, but we have a very exciting night. I was really hoping Jeff could be here so we could have the full What's the Scuttlebutt ensemble together, have the full crew, but returning with us tonight, we have a special guest, but first, Dennis Blocker is here, and he's for, I don't know if we'll get the video out for this, probably will, but he's dressed in the nines in his perfect Popeye impression, minus the beard. You pull the Navy look off quite well, sir.
Oh, thanks. It must be my grandfather's, both in World War II with Navy.
That and your passion for the topic comes through.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's come back. He's returned home for a short period of time, here to promote his book and bring us up to date with all the things going on in his life, Mr. Henry Sledge. Henry, how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm good. Good to see you guys.
Good to see you.
Sir.
I almost feel like a poor man's version of Hollywood Square. It's back to have you back in the lower square, sir. Center square takes the run.
I just imagine Paul Lynn sitting there.
Uh-huh. Real quick, I've talked about it before. I'll talk about it with you real quick. I don't know why nostalgia. Maybe I enjoy watching TV programs that was aired the year I was born. I went through my WKRP in Cincinnati phase. Now on Roku TV, I've been watching Match Game 78, Match Game 76.
Those are good.
They hold up. They're great. You can see how much we've changed. Charles Nelson Reilly. All I can say is Charles Nelson Reilly. He's so funny. Yeah. And I've put this out there a few times. If you haven't done so, it's from 2015. Go on YouTube and look up The Life of Reilly. It's the one-man show of Charles Nelson Reilly where he explains his entire life. And his early years, I'm like, is he bullshitting? Pause, Google. For example, he's talking about how they were poor, but him and his buddy handed out tickets for the local Barnum and Bailey Brothers Circus in Connecticut. And they went. And his buddy freaked out because the big top caught on fire. Pause, Googled it. Yeah, it's the historical fire in Connecticut that killed like 15 people. And young Charles Nelson Reilly was in the stands. And like his life story about his become best friends with Burt Reynolds, being told early in his career he'll never be on TV because, you know, they don't allow queers on television. It's a fantastic one-man show. It's called Life of Reilly. If you guys love the Match Game, go check it out. You'll be happy you did. But yeah, I just got to get that out there. I for like 2 months straight, anytime I was cooking or doing anything that didn't really need my attention, I just turn on the Match Game, and I'd get the answer right most of the time.
Yeah, he was great.
Betty White never aged, by the way. If we're talking about old celebrities, go on the Buzzer channel on Roku or Freebie, and they have game shows from like the 1950s and 1960s. When Betty White was 30, she looked young, but when she started doing the Match Game, her hair went blonde from being brown. You know, no, she's been around for freaking ever, and no, she did not age at all. But speaking of not aging at all, we haven't seen your pretty face in a while. It looked like you got a fresh haircut for the holidays. What have you been up to, Mr. Henry Sledge?
Doing good, man. Just, you know, the thing keeping me busy these days, obviously, is the book. Trying to get it ready. It's supposed to come out June 3rd. So,
wow.
You know, it's, yeah, I mean, that's kind of been like at the forefront for a while. So I don't know how far down in the, we're trying to put a coat on my dog here because she's cold. Here,
right here. That's quality content. Let's watch.
Lulu, come over here. Come here. I just got the, you know, I living through it now, I'm seeing the stages that you go through to get a book to life. And so my managing editor sent me the internal layout edit, if you want to call it that, where like actually seeing what the typeface is going to look like and all that kind of thing. And, you know, seeing the photographs in there and the maps and all that. And this is all electronic. None of this is by paper. And so I had to, you know, go through that and make comments and correct. She's fine down here. I don't care. Okay. Make comments and corrections and that kind of thing. And so, you know, it took me a couple weeks to get through it, but you know, I literally just sent it back today. And, I mean, I don't know, you know, how much you want me to talk about that, but that's what's cooking, man. I mean, it's,
Let's start here. I'll just interview you from soup to nuts while maintaining a full-time job, maintaining your role as a father and a husband. How long did it take you from, how long did it take you from writing your sample that you sent out to try to get a publisher to today when you just finally wrapped up that? What vaguely, how many hours or how many months, how long has this process been for you?
Sure. So I'm trying to stay in the lane of what you're asking me and not go back to the beginning. This time last year was I had had the manuscript finished for a couple months, and I had it. I was talking to like John McManus, Saul David, guys like that, friends of mine, people who've advised me along the way. And the question this time last year on my mind, where I was with it, Don and Dennis, was, you know, do I want an agent or do I want to try to do this by myself? And it really, I mean, unlike our buddy Dave Holland, who's about to get his book out, who didn't do an agent, I wanted an agent. I mean, you know, John McManus told me I have an agent, you know, and he actually tried to hook me up with his guy, but that his guy wouldn't take anybody new. James Scott he offered to hook me up with his agent, but he said he had tried to hook Jonathan Parshall up with his agent and his agent blew him off. So it's this really weird dynamic, man. But I ended up signing this time last year, almost exactly a year ago, maybe in another week, it'll be a year ago that I signed with Greg Johnson, who's been a great agent. He's become a friend of mine. He's Adam Makos's agent. He's Marcus Brotherton's agent, to name a couple among many others. But, you know, that's what was going on this time last year. And at that point, is that kind of where sure. you wanted me? Okay.
I mean, so, our everyday listeners kind of have a timeline because they know when you left the show. And when you left the show, I said, he didn't quit. He left to write a book.
Right.
And yeah, so from that time until this time last year, you're working on the manuscript. Not a whole lot of detail there. But like I said, you're working on this manuscript while maintaining a full-time job, being a father, being a husband, and doing everything else. And that,
I mean, look, one of the things, so when I finished, well, so I signed with Greg about this time, it was in January. And then I had to do what they call a meta data form. Dennis, you may know what that is, and you too, Don, but that is where they send, it's like a freaking massive homework assignment. And it's, you're listing every website, every, like, what's the scuttlebutt with this many followers, you know, real history with Jared Frederick, who, you know, those videos are, last year he and Andrew, his producer, sat with me here and we did a watch along with the Pacific, did the whole thing. Those videos are coming out every 2 weeks. You list all that kind of stuff.
That's a good point. And I never thought about that because I'm old. I was watching a singer. I was watching something, whether it's TikTok, YouTube, something. It was he was either a singer, a comedian, or an actor, something like that. And he brought up the fact that when he was trying to find an agent or a talent scout or whatever, they brought up the fact, how many followers do you have on X, Y, and Z? That is your social media imprint is huge now, whether you're a band, an actor, a comedian, an aspiring author. And it's like, for people our age, you know, you're working at, that's another deficit, right? Unless you're like somebody, you know, you're part of a podcast or, you know, you just so happen to have a following. Could you imagine, like, if you're just up and starting on a whim with, you know, and your social media footprint wasn't there? At the end of the day, would it hurt? it hurts when it comes to finding someone who's willing to represent you, because that's what it's insane how much that matters.
It does. It absolutely does. And so I it took me a couple weeks to do that metadata form. And I mean, honestly, I'm going to be honest. Greg sent this thing to me. It was like a 14 part, electronic thing to do. And it took me like 2 weeks to do it. And I did everything I could, and I sent it to him and said, Greg, you're going to have to fill in the rest. I've done all I can do, Yeah. And I had to, like, the descriptive copy that, which, by the way, I mean, that my book, if you want to see what the cover looks like, it's on Amazon right now. You can pull it up for pre-order.
What is the title of your book? I don't think we've always kind of kept it kind of secret, so we've never officially announced the book.
Well, that's a great question. So the title of the book is The Old Breed, The Complete Story Revealed. The subtitle is A Father, A Son, and How World War II and the Pacific Shaped Their Lives. And that was not what I wanted to call it. I like that title. You know, that's what we're going with. But this is where you get into the mechanics. And Dennis, you've written a book. You probably kind of know what I'm talking about. This is where you get into the mechanics of, like, artistically, okay? In my heart, I wanted to call it Out of the Abyss. That was my working title all along. And the reason for that was because my dad used the term, you know, when I was a kid and he was writing with The Old Breed, and I remember seeing him scratching away, as we've talked about so many times. I said, what are you going to name? You know, what would a 15-year-old kid ask? What are you going to name it? Of course. And he wanted to call it Into the Abyss. The abyss being that hopeless maw of emotional and physical deprivation and despair that is combat, that is warfare, that kills your friends and possibly kills you, and that changes you immutably.
And if I remember correctly, I think he may have used that phrase on the chapter where he's talking about how he sees the dead Marine in the foxhole as a passage of time. He knows how long he's been up on that hill or going back and forth by the amount of decomposition in that body and how it affects his dreams. I think he mentioned it being sucked into the abyss or something during chapter.
And also he did. And he also said when they came back out off Peleliu to get on the Sea Runner to go back to Pavuvu, he said, I felt like this exhausted insect crawling up out of the abyss of Peleliu. And so, as you know, Don, better, because Dennis, I just haven't talked to you as much. So much of what I do, so much of why I do what I do, is I want to be a voice for the fact that my dad, that Eugene Sledge, made it out of the abyss of war. Did he struggle? Did he have nightmares? Did they show that in Ken Burns' The War? Did they show it in the Pacific? Absolutely they did. But I take it upon myself to be living proof that he had a great life. By his own grit and determination, he pulled himself out of the abyss. He met my mom. They had a wonderful marriage. Had my brother and me. Had a good career. He had a good life. He pulled himself out of the abyss. And I really wanted to call my book that. And Greg, he said, Henry, I like it. I get it. I understand why you want to call it that. But he said, I'm your agent. My job is to help you sell this thing. And he said, I'm going to come up with something that's going to, you know, here we go, guys. It's going to check those algorithms. He came back to me and he said, here's what I've got. Out of the Abyss. Or he said, The Old Breed, The Complete Story Revealed, and then A Father, Son, How World War II, The Pacific Shaped Their Lives. He said, I think that checks the boxes. And so that's where we are with that. But Don, can you pull up anything on Amazon, display it on the screen, or is that?
Yeah, I can.
Because, and I really hate to just suck up all the attention here, but I want you guys to see the cover.
No, we want to know. This is awesome.
The cover is when here a couple months ago when my editor, you know, when they were going through their process after I'd signed with them and they had the manuscript and all that, and there's a story there, but we don't have to get into it unless y'all want to. But
she said, we got as much time as you have, so if you want to tell the story, please do.
Well, we can talk about whatever you want. But she said, what do you envision the cover looking like? And I said, I want it to be a throwback to the first edition cover of With the Old Breed. I want the same color. the same color scheme, you know, that deep sepia tone. There it is.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to hang on 1 second. So,
yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's the, you know, what's interesting, Dennis, while Henry's getting what he's retrieving, I've seen that photo, but I've always seen the cleaned up where someone has decided to turn it into a black and white photo. I don't think I've really ever seen the sepia tone version of it.
So here, yeah, what you've seen, Don, and by the way, this photo, here's the actual photo.
Hold on, let me, for video's sake, let me stop sharing this, and that way we can get your photo full screen. Okay. Okay. Yep.
So there's the actual photo. I know you got some glare. That's the actual, and my dad's handwriting's on the back telling who each guy is.
Does your father remember who shot that photo? Was it a friend, or was it just some random?
It was a friend. It was another Marine, because this is up on the, probably on the Motobu Peninsula on Okinawa after the battle was over.
Hmm.
Okay. I knew that photo was not using with the old breed, but that's my dad in the center with his helmet tilted. But I wanted the same typeset font, the same coloration, different photo. You know, I'm not aping anything. I'm not copying with the old breed, but I wanted an homage to the first edition.
Is he wearing a helmet, or is he wearing his HPT cap? I think he's wearing his HPT cap. Is he not?
My dad's the one with the tilted helmet.
Up in the middle.
No, he's
kneeling. No, he's down on the knee with the flag. Never mind.
Yeah, he's kneeling down. He's got his pipe and his helmet tilted over.
Yep, I see it.
So, you know, and you see Tom Hanks blurbed it. I asked him to blurb it. He did.
That's awesome.
And God, don't even get me going. So you notice with the old breed, you have the 1st Marine Division patch. You have the EGA.
Can I guess? I have not talked to you about this, but I know.
You're going to get it.
I bought my first HPT uniform in 11 years ago. About 2.5 years after that, just so happened, Dennis and I were perusing at the front before the show. At the front, had to stop putting them in production because United States Marine Corps got tired of people selling tchotchke crap at Walmart with their EGA on it. And now you have to buy a license to publish their EGA because they don't want people selling crappy knockoffs at gas stations and Walmart with the United States Marine Corps logo on it.
The EGA has been trademarked since 2007.
Wow.
So when I found that out, I was like, okay, pull the EGA. And I looked into it, and there's a story here. All right, pull the EGA. We're not going to do it. So they left 1st Marine Division, the Blue Diamond. They left that on there. Well, my cover, it looked kind of weird just having the cover up there.
Off balance.
You know, on one side, it didn't look symmetrical. So they ended up pulling that off. All right. So I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. I mean, you can't always get everything you want. So here, not too long ago, I have become friends with a guy named Rob Barrow, who General Barrow was the Commandant of the Marine Corps in the first Gulf War. Rob is his son. Rob's a retired Marine colonel. Talking to Rob, and I've gotten some amazing endorsements for this book, guys. I mean, I got to say, I just happened to mention Rob. I mean, I've got, you know, Saul David, John McManus, James Holland, Tom Hanks, Jared, our buddy Jared. I've gotten some beautiful endorsements for this thing. Dan Carlin. Just some over-the-top endorsements for us. But I told Rob Barrow, I said, Rob, I really want some buy-in from the Corps, right? Like, I want
their stamp.
Marine general, somebody really high level to weigh in on this and give me a blurb, if they will. He said, I'll get right back to you. So I now have a blurb or endorsements, you know, blurb being the slang term, from a General Anthony Zinni, who was in the Corps back many years ago. They called him the Godfather. He gave me an incredible endorsement. And then General Charlie Wilhelm, who was 1st Marine Division commander many years ago, he gave an incredible endorsement. The other thing that Rob is helping me do, he has written a letter to the Judge Advocate General and head counsel of the Marine Corps to see if I can use the 1st Marine Division patches. Division patches are not trademarked. Division patches, unit patches, insignia, that's not trademarked. But my publisher just didn't, you know, they wanted to err on the side of caution, and I didn't want to fight. You know, I didn't want to fight them on it, so I was like, fine, just pull the division patch. Talking to Rob Barrow, he's like, look, man, I think it'd be cool if he could at least have the division patch on the back cover. So he has written this beautiful letter to the Judge Advocate General of the Marine Corps, or the Judge Advocate of the Marine Corps, to see if they will give me permission. But Don, I got on the website to apply for permission, and 5 minutes later, I'm like, F it, I'm out. I'm done. I'm not going through this bureaucracy.
Juice is not worth the squeeze?
No, it's not. So I told Rob that, and he's like, look, let me make some calls. I mean, the dude's dad was former commandant. He's got pull, you know. So he wrote a beautiful letter to the JAG. We'll see what happens. You know, they may come back and refuse permission, and that's fine. I mean, you saw the cover. I think it looks pretty good.
It looks great.
It's awesome.
I want to say, don't quote me on this. I'm having this weird memory flash. It wasn't me because I got my uniform pre. I swear, because after a while, at the front resolved that issue. They got licenses, whatever. Somehow they're making them. I swear, whether it's a Facebook photo or in real life, somebody had one. I think when you buy the uniforms, it comes with a cardboard card with a silver, just like a like the stickers on the hat, the national insignia of the NFL. I think it has a hologram Marine Corps like stripe on a cardboard tag that comes with it, showing that it is a licensed product, much like a starter jersey or a hat. I vaguely remember that. It's somewhere in my mind. So yeah, it was an issue. I remember when they cracked that down, because people were writing that from like, oh, just put out blank ones. We'll make our own stamp. The guy's like, no, I'm either going to do this or I'm not. And obviously he got around it, because you can still get them. But yeah.
So, Henry, can I ask you can I ask a question?
Absolutely, man.
One thing that really stood out to me, and you were describing getting the book together, you use the term that you brought it to life, right? You brought the book to life. One of the ways that I described the sorrow that I felt of having my books in storage when I was moving, and they were in storage for months, and I just had such, it's kind of weird, but I had such sorrow that all my books were shut up in a dark, a dark shed with, you know, silverfish running around them in there. And the way I described it when I finally got them out was I described it that my books are breathing again. They're on the shelves. They're out. They've been dusted off and they're breathing again. So that really struck a chord with me when you described it, bringing it to life. And I wonder, was there any special moments when you were compiling everything? And did you get any gut punches when you were working that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, people like us who are book nerds, especially for World War II books. I don't know that I would describe it as a gut punch, Dennis, but I mean, the whole thing was just so important to me. I mean, if to show you this, I mean, so, you know, the deal behind this was so much stuff got excised from With the Obrey when it got written. When I got permission from Auburn University, who has my dad's original unedited manuscript, to get that. And this, now we're going back to fall of 2021, and to start working on this, it was 820 pages. And they sent it to me electronically. First, they had to go into closed papers in the archives and assemble it. You know, that was a little more complicated than you might think. Well, they did. And because all my dad's documents, letters, and everything that he turned over to Auburn University were very carefully articled and cataloged and all that.
Now, but
the original manuscript.
To that point, when they store a manuscript like that, do they put something in between the pages to keep them from sticking? Do they kind of, since it's not a binded book, you said they had to reassemble it. Do they kind of separate the pages?
There were file folders.
Okay. Oh, okay. I got you.
Now, there's an expanse, like, if you want to know what the handwritten, and you've heard me talk about this, man. My dad wrote in pencil on yellow legal pads. I saw him do it a billion times. I talk about it in my book. The handwritten manuscript With the Old Breed is a stack of yellow legal pads in an expandable folder. Wow. And it's probably about yay big. Now, but I didn't want that. You know, I wanted the typed, because my dad, I couldn't do what I needed to do with a handwritten pencil, you know, manuscript.
He spent too much time trying to figure out what he's saying.
Oh, yeah. You know, so they, the archivist down there did a great job, and I thanked him very profusely in my acknowledgments, of going through all his, because his original manuscript is not in his regular papers that, you know, a historian of from anywhere could access if they're writing something about Eugene Sledge. It was in closed papers where only members of the family can see it. And since, and this gets into some esoteric business stuff that when we turned the manuscript over to him years ago, they could have said, we respect what you're doing, Henry, but you gave us, your family gave us this manuscript to be stewards of it and protect it. We're not letting you do this.
Yeah.
They could have done that. So I tried to be very, you know, I put on a sport coat and a nice shirt and everything. We did a Zoom call. And fortunately, I mean, Greg Schmidt, the head archivist, he said, well, look, it was his call. And I explained to him what I wanted to do. My mom was still in good health back then. She was sitting there with me. And, you know, because she was the inspiration. She was the one who suggested to me that I do this. And he said, look, if the family of Eugene Sledge wants that manuscript so that Henry can write a book with that material, we're not opposed. How can we help?
Wow.
And it took about 2 weeks of several Zoom calls of them going in, you know, with a video camera and saying, okay, here's this file. Here's the pages it has. And, I mean, it took about 2 weeks for us to figure out, okay, yeah, okay, where you are, that box right there, those files, that's what I need.
Wow.
They sent it to me electronically. And give me just a second, okay?
Sure.
Sure.
The amount of energy, time, and organization, and I don't say teamwork, definitely teamwork, to get this idea off the ground. Because like Henry said, this took 2 weeks. This is 2 weeks of somebody working like 4 hours a day or, you know, a couple hours a day on top of the regular work schedule to make this happen, to make this come to life. That's huge.
So they scanned it electronically, sent it to me. I think it's a PDF. And I took it to Kinko's and had it put on a thumb drive. And then I had them print it. Or I put it on a thumb drive on my computer, took it to Kinko's, had them print it. And this is what it looks like printed.
Yeah.
This is the entire
unedited
manuscript to my dad's book. Okay. Four of these books, 200 pages each.
Wow.
And what was the published book with the old breed? It was 357 pages?
Yeah. Well, the trade paperback edition published out at 312.
Okay.
So then I went through, and I don't know if you can see this, but basically you probably, can you tell that I've highlighted?
Yeah, stuff? We can see your red pencil marks.
So I went through every one of the, I wore out five highlighters. I had with the old breed in one hand, highlighters in the other, and all this. And I spent months, literally every sentence that did not get published, I highlighted. So that, and then when I, that took months when I've written down the dates on, you know, how long it took. And when I finished that, then I went back and reread it. And said, okay, well, and believe it or not, there's a lot of stuff that I didn't bring over into my book.
Really?
I picked what I thought was the best stuff. But here's the thing. Let's jump ahead. When I finished transcribing all of what got edited out into my book and as writing my narrative to string it all together.
Yeah.
Right? Because I didn't want to just reproduce with the old breed. I wanted it to be my work. And when I did all that, Don,
you had another 700 pages.
It was 164,500 words.
that's right? A hell of a read. What is that, War and Peace?
My agent, Greg's like, Henry, look, man, I get what you want to do. That is a big ass book. He said that, man, that's going to be 700 pages. He said, well, you know, he says, I'm here to serve this project, be your agent. But he said, I'm telling you, you want this book to sell, right? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. He said, we got to get it down to about 110,000 words. And so I said, okay.
And that's such a hard decision because now you got to cut words that's already been cut before. Because like you said, if you cut out your stuff and leave his, then you're just basically reprinting his work. And so now you got to decide what of your new content gets cut, plus what his gets cut a second time.
Yeah.
And got then cut from the Little League team for the second season in a row.
Yeah.
Is what you're cutting connected to something else that now you got to refigure, okay, well, I got to connect to this differently now because this whole part is gone now.
Your continuity screwed up.
Believe it or not, guys, I mean, I guess I just had such an impetus driving me to do this that it, well, long story short, so I sat down when Greg got post, when he got the deal with Post Hill Press, my publisher, and we signed with him, he said, okay, Henry, 110,000 words is what you need to shoot for. And so I said, okay. And then, so through last summer, guys, what I was doing was going back through and just, it's like my buddy John Caratola at the World War II Museum. He says, oh, it's like killing 50,000 of your own children.
Yeah.
You're picking out exactly what you just said, Dennis. You're pick stuff that I wrote, like, okay, I got to cut that, you know? And so I did, you know, and I got it. I got it. The internal layout, I think it's right at 116,000 words. So it's going to publish out at about 322 pages, which is, you know, that's going to be a good length.
And yeah. Thank God for Microsoft Word count.
Oh, yeah.
Pete's taking a pencil one. One, two.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure, like your mom and dad had to do back in the day. One. Guess, yeah. Estimate how many letters do we fit on a page? Let's guesstimate, and then we'll count the pages.
I've got a file folder in the back room there of, think now, this is in 1979 when mm-hmm. my dad started working with, I think it was Bob Smith, who was his editor. What they did back then, guys, they took the typewritten stuff like this, all right? And actually, you know how the censors did in World War II with the little razor blades?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly, like, I've got this thing, and it was only about 50 pages worth, but I've got it back there, where he had gone through and cut out, literally cut with a razor, little sentences.
It looks like the defective work from a player piano.
My goodness.
And so, at first, like, I saw that, and this is before my guys at Auburn found the manuscript that they found, because I'm thinking, man. What if that's all they can find?
Oh, yeah.
I'm never going to be able to do this.
Holy cow.
Actually, that wasn't the case.
Man.
But it wasn't that hard. I mean, they sent what they sent me. I went through a highlight. I told you what I, you know, and then I went back through and put orange brackets around what I thought I wanted to use. And, you know, so yeah, man. I mean that's kind of how it came to life. If that
tease the audience a little bit, is there maybe a particular campaign that was covered briefly in the original context that maybe we see a little more detail in on your book?
So I felt like, I mean, that's a great question. So, well, here I'll tell you this: the landing at Peleliu. Okay. I mean, God, I've been through with the old breed so many times. I've read it and read it and read it because, guys, I swear I don't think anybody, and there'll probably be somebody, you know, who just makes some random comment when they review it on Amazon that says I did it, but I don't think anybody can say that, well, all he did was just crib his dad's book and throw a little introduction. I wanted to be so sure that, like, here's with the old breed, and you take my stuff, I wanted it to be this progression, right?
That's awesome.
You know, so I've been through mine, God knows how many times, with the old breed, God knows how many times. But to answer your question, Don, the landing at Peleliu, when I read the way it was edited for with the old breed, which they did a beautiful job, would never change that. Like, for the what I was able to use to craft for, you know, my narrative of describing the landing at Peleliu plus his unpublished stuff, the thing that struck me was the Amtrak ride going in. You hear in With the Old Breed how, you know, like they bumped into another Amtrak and their engine stalled, and, you know, what really it was a longer process, and what I pulled out from the unpublished stuff and have in my book is the reef. When they were crossing the reef, you know, like he described in great detail how when the amphibious tractor is lurching up over, the reef itself, it was such a rough ride, and they're all just being thrown around in the back of the LVT into each other.
Wow.
And then, you know, it floats free in deeper water, but it did that like two more times, alternately getting up on rock, on coral, getting into a little bit deeper water and floating, and the engine's roaring the whole time. Jet mortar shells are starting to
vomit all over the floor, people sliding.
Yeah. So, but that process took longer. That was one thing that struck me. And there's more, but I don't want to give the story away, but that I thought that was pretty interesting. And then the other thing, I mean, there was some good Peleliu stuff, but man, Okinawa just was like this horrific nightmare that never ended. I mean, a lot of greats. And I ended up having to cut some of that to keep mine, you know, within a readable length. Cause I mean, I swear, I don't want this thing to be so long that people are just like, oh my God, I cannot finish this.
Yeah, you could always wait 3 years, 4 years, do the special edition, uncut, full flank. You want to read this version, the box set version.
But yeah, Okinawa, there was some pretty incredible stuff too. So, I don't ever try to oversell anything, guys. I mean, it was pretty cool stuff to me. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, you know, I could pull up some of what these endorsements are, what some of these people.
There's no need. Anybody I know who's owned the book, the series aside, the series doesn't exist. Just anybody I know. Look, I had a client 4 years ago. He watched this miniseries. He was in his 70s or late 60s. He went out and got your father's book. He got Lecky's book. And your father's book, he read two or three times. I don't know anybody, or maybe only know one person who owns With the Old Breed and only read it once and put it on their shelf and moved on.
That's so true. I've read it so many times.
You're talking to a guy with a learning disability. I've read it like five times. So it's a true statement. Put that on the cover. I'm certified by the state of Ohio of having a learning disability, and I read the original context five times. But seriously, and so anybody who has that book, and particularly anybody who has the book and then loves the miniseries, not to overdo it, but it's almost like it would be like the equivalent of a Star Wars fan before Disney bought out Star Wars, not wanting to read another Star Wars book, right? So people have been dying for some new context and content, you know, based on those stories, and you know it's going to be great. Let me ask you this:
sure,
obviously you're transcribing. You're taking your father's unpublished content. You're adding some narrative to it. Clearly, you're not cutting and pasting this content from that PDF and putting it in your Word file. You're typing out each word. Oh, look at that vest. That's adorable. When you're transcribing your father's words and you literally have to do it word for word in order for it to be his unpublished work, did you find yourself kind of trying not to, maybe instinctively, maybe trying to modernize the words and realize, oh, that's not how he wrote it. I got to go back and put it in exactly.
Well, so here's the thing. That's a great question. And this was where I was kind of fortunate in my, you know, having to whittle things down to a shorter word count. My dad was really a pretty verbose writer, you know? And so I don't feel any negative feelings in the way I had to handle this at all because just obviously being as close to this as I am, having read With the Old Breed so many times, having seen literally, I mean, it's really weird when I read With the Old Breed, I'm reading that, but I'm also in the back of my mind, I'm going, but wait a minute, you know, he's talking about being in San Diego, but. And I'm about to give away a little something here. I'm thinking in my mind about the part where they all went out to see the chorus girls one night. One of the hot chorus girls said, "Hey, Marine, you're cute. I want to dance with you." It was the first time he'd ever worn his dress blues.
Hmm.
You know, and I'm hearing that, you know, and so to me, it's this contiguous thing. But to kind of try to speak to your question, Don, I mean, look, I had to. There were a lot of his sentences that I edited, okay? But
Strictly for economy of words. Writings.
Huh?
Strictly for economy of words.
Economy of word. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I didn't change the heart of what he said, but I might have shortened it for the sake of, and look, man, I mean, I know my dad's writing style better than anybody on this planet. And so I don't feel like anything's being bastardized at all to use that. If I may be so bold as to say that, you know.
Absolutely. I was going to throw in a This Isn't a Battle of the Bulge episode joke, but
this is like one of the books I'm looking forward to the most this year. I just can't wait. Well, like a kid at Christmas. I'm just like, oh my gosh.
And so as we mentioned earlier, it is for sale, pre-sale. Head over to Amazon, pre-sale. You guys buy it on pre-sale. You'll get it when it comes out. But the pre-sale numbers do help. I know this from listening to countless authors on Adam Carolla's podcast, from having authors here. Pre-sale numbers do help. So if you guys are looking to buy this book or plan on buying in June, go to the WTSPWorldWar2.com. Find this episode. It's be on the homepage. Go there. We'll have a link to Amazon. Get this thing ordered on pre-order. It goes a long way. And who knows? Hopefully and probably so, maybe this thing will hit some high numbers. And if it hits super high numbers that look great for Henry's publisher before the damn thing even comes out, it'll all be better for Henry too. So, you know, this, feel free to head over to Amazon and pre-order it.
Well, you know,
because you're going to buy it anyhow, so why not? Just let's get this pre-order number up.
I appreciate that, but I mean, look, I would, when I spoke at the World War II conference back in November 22, and this was much earlier in this process, Dr. Conrad Crane was doing a presentation, and we all the speakers went out to dinner, and he and I were sitting next to each other, and he was asked about this. He was really excited about it. And he's a strategic air power guy. I have not read one of his books, but I've gotten to know him. Really cool guy. Been with the World War II Museum, speaks there quite a bit. And he said, look, man, do what you're doing here, but your next project needs to be take this and publish it in its entirety.
Yeah.
And so that could be an interesting thing to think about, but I mean, not while I've got a day job, man. I mean, you know, it's yeah. We've got kids, we've got jobs. Y'all know how it is. I mean, well,
that was a question I had too. Now that you, as a father, working full time, writing a book in the after hours, and I think we may have mentioned this, you and I mentioned this on a private phone call in the past, does it kind of put you in your father's steps thinking about back in 1977, 76 when your mom, not only just your father, but both your parents after hours were toiling away on not a nice computer laptop, but on typewriter, just clickety-clack, cling.
Oh, yeah. I talk about all of that in, because so much of that, and it's why, I mean, man, that's why I wanted to hew to that I wanted to pay homage to that first edition cover.
Yeah.
Because that is, I mean, guys, what you just said, I mean, trust me, that is all over my manuscript, because those are the memories. I mean, we've talked about the book by George McMillan, The Old Breed, about the 1st Marine Division.
Yep.
You know, that had Sid Phillips' notes in it and had my dad's notes in it. You know, I mean, I would sit at his knee while he was writing in his study as a 12-year-old kid, an 11-year-old kid, and just look through that book and look at the illustrations in there. And, you know, Dennis, like you, I mean, I was thinking of this when you said what you said, man. I still remember the way that book smelled. Because that just was visceral to me, man. I mean, that, like, that book and talking about these guys on this horrible island called Pavuvu getting ready for Peleliu, who had just come from Cape Gloucester, you know, I mean, that was imprinted in my childhood.
Wow.
And I talk about all of that. I mean,
oh, man.
You know, so it, because, I mean, that was where it all started.
Man, that's amazing. I'm so stoked.
Yeah, I wish, I mean, I'm amazed, and I'm saying this humbly, guys. I mean, the people who, especially these Marine generals, man, the people who have endorsed this thing and what they've said about it, yeah, man, it's really blown me away. I mean, honestly.
Well, that's great. I mean, it just goes to show that your mom's, you know, idea for this and your idea for this, it's well-founded. And as, you know, when you broach the idea with Jeff and I and you know, talk to our other author friends of the show, everybody's like, do it. We all want this. And so I'm not surprised that you're getting great feedback from all these people and all this great endorsements.
And Henry, don't shy away from the praise or the accolades or in speaking opportunities, or because even though what you're talking about and what you wrote is a lot about people who actually died, real people, what you need to keep in mind, because we're Christians, most likely. Are you a Christian, sir?
Yeah. Do that.
Yes, sir. So
I'm not a jewelry guy. So
the thing about Christians is that we're very self-defacing and are self-effacing, and and we don't want to toot our own horns and talk about what we've done, and that works against our goal. And this was told to me by an experienced author who was seeing my own self sabotaging my efforts to get the work done. Because the truth of the matter is, sir, you put in hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of time, and being a dad and full-time job, that meant you were up burning candlelight and getting up early and staying up late. And so you did the work. And now when it was explained to me to help me over that was that you're the voice of these folks who have no opportunity, and it's been passed to you. And so I'm super proud of everything you did, all the hard work, all the toil, all of the heartbreak of hearing you got to cut this amount of words. I was there too. And, I know it's a gut punch when you hear that kind of stuff, because you really fall in love with the way that you crafted, even spending 5 minutes of time on the placement of a comma, because it changes the flow of a sentence. And it's like you have that much investment into it, and then you're told you got to cut, 50,000 words or whatever. And you're just like, oh my gosh, but you do it. And I'm very proud of you. And I'm so excited. I'm so excited for this. And anyway, yeah.
I appreciate the kind words, man. I really do.
Well, I appreciate all the hard work you did. And you didn't, you kept after it. And you made it happen. I'm so excited.
Let me
that.
Say this as the only person on the show who hasn't published a book. To do what the two of you have done, and multiple books for Dennis, and still in the works, how many times in our lives have we met somebody who either A, trying to start a band, get a music career, wanting to write a book, wanting to write a screenplay, not that they didn't get it published, but just the fact that most of them never get the words on paper, let alone get the movie produced. But just the fact that you put in the time, energy, and effort, the both of you, to take your idea, to brainstorm it, start it, and go through whatever your process is, forget even publishing the thing, but just the fact that you both have a piece of work that you came up with an idea, whether it was on the toilet in a car ride or late one night watching TV, the fact that the both you guys have put in the energy, time, and effort, that says a lot, because I know so many people who've had ideas of things they want to do, and they don't even put the first whatever in play to do whatever their goal may be. So props to both of you. And then the fact that both of you have gotten your works out there for people to acquire and to attain, hats off to both of you. Because it's not easy, especially when it comes to writing.
I'll say something and then let Dennis speak, because I certainly don't want to do all the talking here. I mean, to your point, Don, I mean, this was always going to happen once my mom inspired me to do it, and I dedicate it to her. But one of the last things she said to me before she died was, Henry, finish that book. God, I was able to get that out without cracking up. Thank you. But yeah, I mean, she that was literally one of the last things she said to me.
That's beautiful.
Wow. Man,
which I mean, I was going to do it anyway, but
now you have a directive.
Yes, exactly what happened. Well, to
Mama
me.
Said you got to do it.
Really,
my mom looking at me, and after her dad killed himself,
yeah.
And her being afraid that his nightmares is what took him over the edge because she remembered him screaming at night when she was a kid in the 50s, hearing him scream at night and grandma telling everybody, it's just, you know, dad's okay, dad's okay.
I mean, hearing Dennis say what he just said, man, I'm, that's heavy stuff, man.
Yeah.
Well, it was a very hard day when that news dropped. And, you know, grandpa was a hero of mine. And I saw his Navy picture on the mantle and, as a kid growing up. And so, you know, I'd be playing with my soldiers on the concrete outside, and grandpa would come back with his Ford truck from working all day. And, I could hear that Ford engine just chugging its way up the alley there. And I'd get out of the way and he'd laugh as he came by and he'd ask who's winning, you know? And he was just this larger than life guy. And then I passed him up, you know, I was 6'1" and grandpa was 5'6". And I still looked up to him. I still looked up to him. And, you know, I think about him with his nightmares and all that, and how, you know, he was able to come back home and be so productive and a dad and raise 6 kids, and he never beat them, and he never took it out on them, and they were married, for him and my grandma married forever. And but when she died, you know, he lost that
anchor.
There you go, that anchor. Yeah. And then that removed that buffer, and he took care of that. He killed himself, shot himself, dialed 911, and then when they said 911, state your emergency, they just heard that pop, you know, and then the police made entry. But what's interesting, Henry, and your book and your dad's book, and your book's going to touch so many people's lives, mm-hmm. people that haven't even been born yet. And what's wild is that journey my mom started me on, I think about all that, all those people that lives were changed, the farmers that I met and interviewed in Illinois and Missouri and Wisconsin, and all those different places that I went, all started from that one simple act of grandpa killing himself. And it's really interesting. And tonight before the podcast, I had a phone call from an avid listener of the podcast, Andrew Buher.
Yeah, I know Andrew.
Andrew?
Yeah.
We had a really nice talk.
He's from Michigan, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, on a farm out there. And he's got an idea for a book. And a World War II book he's been researching. And we had a nice long talk about that. And it just gets you fired up. It gets you fired up, excited.
Since you said his name, can I say something really quick?
Yeah.
Andrew, please. If he's listening, I owe him an apology, because he and I have talked, but he reached out to me again. And I didn't reply because I was neck deep in all this other. And I really hate to be so self-centered that somebody's honoring me by asking me for an opinion or help, and I don't get to them, and I feel bad about that. So, Andrew, if you're out there and you hear it, I'm sorry.
He definitely will hear. He's an avid listener. Yeah.
You know, I just had another memory. Before the show, we were talking about growing up, my grandparents owned a property on the Ohio River. And I remember one time, God, I was probably 5 or 6, maybe 7. Me and my cousins, my grandma, my mom, were all out there. And by this time, the rule was you had to wear shoes in the river because the pollution was so bad, people cut themselves. But I remember my poor grandfather came down, and he'd cut off some jeans. His legs were white as the snow, driven snow. And it's August in summertime. You know, he's got his dark arms from farmer's tan, but his legs were just white as the driven snow because he always wore denim pants. And he had a life belt on, not a life jacket, a 1980s bright yellow life belt. And he comes down, and my grandma, my mom, my uncles are all busting their, you know, my grandma's case, busting her husband's balls, my mom and her brother. I make fun of their dad. Oh, look at you. Turns out he was terrified to swim. And it's the only time it ever came up, terrified to swim. Thinking about it now, my question was, granted, he grew up a coal miner and worked in a dairy farm. Was he terrified to swim before going off to war and trouncing around on naval ships all the time, and Lord knows what he's seen over there. And if he was, could you imagine how much more terrifying it would be to take a landing craft in or be stuck on a boat for weeks at a time, being deathly terrified to swim? So I don't know which one came first, the chicken or the egg. I don't know what would be worse, being terrified of water and swimming before and living through all that, or developing that because of possibly maybe something he witnessed or was a part of that formed
that. This was
your grandfather? Yeah, my grandfather.
Which branch was he in?
He was in the Army. He's the one, he worked grave registration.
Okay.
And he's the one I've had a hard time figuring out, because I have his wedding photo, but in his wedding photo, he has his right sleeve showing.
Mm-hmm.
And as we all know, your right sleeve is, if you have a division patch on your right sleeve, that's your former division when you get transferred to a new one. And so I can see his right sleeve, and I did some research. I always forget the name of it, because it wasn't formed until 1945. It's one of the later divisions, but I found his enlistment paper. He went in 1942. And so, I'm sorry, I can see his left shoulder, but not his right shoulder. So in the wedding photo, I can see his division patch of the division that was formed in 1945, but I know he went in 1942, and I know that he was during grave registration shortly after D-Day. So I have no idea who he served with prior to 45, because sadly, his records were some of the records that were lost in the Great Fire. And so all the research I've done online, I have my dog tags are exact replicas of his. I have his service number. I found his enlistment card, the date he enlisted, where he enlisted at. I have some newspaper clippings. Apparently, his group got a presidential unit citation, which was mentioned in his newspaper clipping. I have a photo of, but it once again doesn't mention his unit. And so I have a lot of mysteries. Dennis and I did an episode a while back. I went through my computer bag, my old laptop bag. I forgot. I went back to Kentucky for my grandmother's funeral in the mid-2000s, and my mom gave me the newspaper clippings from the, it would have been what? So 1940. So the 50th anniversary of D-Day. When was that? That would have been like late
1994. 90s.
Yeah, 94. They had clipped newspaper clippings of the shots from D-Day on the anniversary. My grandmother had written in her hand experiences that my grandfather had. And Dennis and I were trying to read them on the podcast, but kind of like you were saying, when looking at your father's handwritten version, I would never be able to write this book because you can't read, I can barely make out my own grandmother's cursive writing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we were reading vaguely, talking about, I think if I remember correctly, she made a comment that he was talking about, because he did grave registrations, written across the bottom was talking about him seeing limbs hanging in tree branches from, you know, the explosions of landmines, right, and all that stuff. So yeah, he worked grave registration. Clearly there was no post-war glory stories that he ever told. I never really heard firsthand accounts of anything from him. Only information I got was post his death, after I started getting more interested in the topic in my early 30s. The only thing I do have from him that my mom graciously gave to me, because she didn't want me to wait until she passed, and if Jeff was on here, he would know these things are kind of getting hard to find. On the dash, underneath the passenger dashboard of a Jeep, there's a first aid tin. It's about the size of a VCR tape. I have it over here, but I have to move a bunch of stuff. You open up, and it's a full-blown first aid can. I have his that he brought back from the war, because it's green. There it is. But your background. Yeah. So I have the one that he actually brought back from overseas that my mom gave me. It's the only thing of his that I actually have that he brought back from himself in person. But yeah, that's the only thing I really have, other than I recreated his dog tags. So whenever I do my Army impression at World War II events, I'm actually wearing his replica dog tags.
That's awesome.
His name was Preston Coleman Woods. My name's Donald Preston Abernathy. So I have my dad's grandfather's first name, and then my grandfather's first name is my middle name.
That's awesome.
And so, yeah.
Henry, there's a parallel, also another parallel between your story and mine. On Auburn campus, War Eagle, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the campus there's a building called Pebble Hill. and it was the home of Dr. Cecil Yarbrough at one point. And the family, Yarbrough family, donated that home to Auburn University, and it's part of a historical branch where they have a lot of meetings and whatnot. Byron Yarbrough was born and raised there, and he became the executive officer of my grandpa's gunboat at Iwo Jima, and he was killed. And there was a Scotsman, a professor from Auburn, who, when I was there, Auburn had me come out and they gave me an honorarium and they had me speak, and it was just amazing, amazing. So I have just, whenever there's football or whatever, I am hardcore Auburn.
Oh, that's cool.
I am Auburn. But what really moved me was that Scotsman. He was tall, like 6'5", and he, very gregarious, and he came up to me and he was just weeping after I was done. And he says, can I hug you? And I was like, sure, you know. And so we hugged, and he says, Dennis, every morning for the past 2 years, I've been jogging in the mornings, and I go by this cemetery, and there's this beautiful headstone, and it says Byron Yarbrough, to our son lost at sea. And he says, and I always looked at that, and I thought, and I would always say a little prayer for them, that family, wondering about his story. And here we go. He sees in the school paper that I was going to be talking about the Heart of Hell and the LCI 449. And it's just a really amazing opportunity. And they refurbished the home, and they cut one of the original timbers into 4x4 squares, and they gave me a square.
Nice.
And they had it wrapped and ribbon, and with a picture of the house and whatnot. It was just amazing, amazing experience. But once again, you know, all from my mom giving me that directive that your mother gave you.
Yeah.
To get after it.
Well, I mean, look, guys, our veterans, our grandfathers and fathers and uncles, you know, they're gone. I mean, Don, since I've last talked to you, I've talked at a bunch of World War II things, and you know, some of these things, like I was at the Eisenhower National Historic Site back in September, and there were a couple of World War II veterans there, and you know, if you can even have one there, man, they're in a wheelchair. Yep. You know, they've got somebody pushing them around. They if they can even talk. Yep. You know, and so that's just the inexorable passage of time. And now it's on guys like us.
That's right.
Yes, you know, right. Our buddy, Don, our buddy, Jared Frederick. I mean, you know, one of the things he said to me is like, Henry, and he would say the same thing to you, Dennis, and to you, Don. I mean, the torch has been passed to you now. I mean, you know, because we're it now, you know, and yeah. Every time somebody asks me to come speak at something, I mean, I'm honored by it. Obviously it's kind of why I do this, but at the same time, I'm like, man, I wish you could have had my dad, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
His name is Henry Sledge. His book, pre-order now. We'll have the link on WTSPWorldWar2.com. The Old Breed, The Complete Story Revealed, A Father, A Son, and How World War II and the Pacific Shaped Their Lives by W. Henry Sledge. Wow. And as we mentioned before, you can also head over to Amazon.com and order Bonsai Cliffs, Desperation's Edge by Dennis Blocker II. Buy both of these books. Add them to your library. You'll be happy you did. I am tickled pink to, in a small way, at least have the ability to say that I know both you gentlemen, and I'm proud of both of you for getting these books out there. Dennis, I know you have decided to turn your Bonsai Cliff is actually a episode and a series of books to come, because as we've talked about in previous episodes, you were smart enough and had the access to record so many of the vets on those LCIs and LSTs that you're grandfather served with back in the early 2000s, and so you got plenty of material coming down the pipeline. So you guys be sure to check back when Dennis gets the next one out there, and we are so happy for you, Henry, and your book. I yes, know that once happy. The book drops in June, you're going to be doing the media tour, and you're going to be out there getting the word out. And as I stumbled over and accidentally made a saying a couple years ago. I'm going to pass it on to you, and that is, if you want people to hear your music, sometimes you got to toot your own horn. So don't feel bad when you got to press those keys and blowing that mouthpiece.
Yeah, that's
sir.
Right.
Because well, you know, I appreciate it. You Dennis, get that I didn't out know there. That you. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there. I didn't know you. I knew you'd written one book. I didn't know. So you've done two now or more?
I've got four.
Four. God, four. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. No.
Fantastic, man.
Well, yeah. The first one you kind of, you know, you helped, but you didn't get any writing credits, right?
Yeah, that was the one that got me started. That was with Pulitzer Prize winning author Mitch Weiss, and I interviewed 300 people for that one. And then that was a 14-year. That was to tell the story of my grandpa. And then all of the lessons I learned from working with Mitch is what I used to tell two books about my dad in Iraq and Afghanistan with the War Dogs. And then my story of 23 years in emergency medicine as a medic and EMS, and then actually five, if you count that one. And then this latest, the first in the series, the Bonsai Cliff of Saipan. Yeah.
And you can also find a link to that book on WTSPWorldWar2.com as well. You know, we're going to go into what you're reading tonight, but I think we'll save it. We're just so happy to have Henry back. We're so thrilled for him. And
so
as his schedule allows, he's going to be doing drop-in shows. So he'll be back here and there. And so some nights you'll be lucky and have all four of us. Just sadly, Jeff couldn't make it tonight. He really wanted to, but we're coming off the holiday season. If you haven't done so yet, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on that Patreon link. Sign up and subscribe. It goes a long way to help what we're doing here. And head over to YouTube.com. Look for D410 Media. And like and subscribe. You can see some of the podcast episodes in the past. You'll see the video version up for this one here in a week or two. It takes me a little while to edit these. For myself, Dennis, and Henry, real quick, I guess, because you're kind of a guest on this episode. I'm almost interviewing you. So as I do with all of our guests, Henry, where can people find you and find more information on what you got coming down the pipe?
Well, you know, I don't think I've ever answered that question, Don.
You've been here and asked it before, but...
I'm on Facebook, William Henry Sledge. I don't have my own website or anything like that. I am on Instagram, although I hardly at H Sledgehammer, but I never, you know, get on there and post anything. To tell you the truth, man, now that my publisher has things in hand and, you know, of course, they'll send me something and I have to immerse myself in it for a couple of weeks. But I think we're only doing one more round and then it'll be going to final stages. But with all the point being all of that, I just kind of stepped away from social media for a while. But I'm kind of trying to get back out there, you know. But I don't have a website or anything like that. But William Henry Sledge on Facebook.
Or you can head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com or on our Facebook. We'll obviously keep everybody apprised and up to date with everything. There was a cool thing that was a limited series that I would want to talk about if it ever gets to main press again, but we'll save that for another episode. We want to thank each and every one of you for your continued support going into the start of year number 7. Wow, who knew? Side note, as the world's United States is dealing with some snow and flurries, I'm going camping this weekend, and even in Florida, it's going to be like 38. So,
is it really?
Yeah, we're actually having a cold front come through this weekend. Actually, Orlando was supposed to get snow last week, but it didn't happen. I think Saturday when I go out, it's actually going to get maybe the mid 40s. But I just bought a tent that goes in the bed of my Tundra, and so I'm going to test out my new truck tent, and then we're going to get more. We're going to basically me and a buddy of mine. We're camping at a local spot that has nice 12-foot alligators, so that makes me sleep a little better at night knowing I'm in the back of a truck and not laying on the ground. But we're gonna sleep right on the lake, get up in the morning and go fishing and see if we can catch some hogs.
This has been a Digital 410 production.